Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car. Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion, not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Colombo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics, from politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up, Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc, Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Colombo's home on the Colombo Chronicles Live to your home, Colombo says she doesn't want to have to send the familia to make sure you are listening.
That's right. You're listening to the Rose Colombo right here at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. Hope you had a great week. And I definitely had a good week. And it's been interesting to see what's going on around the world. All the issues of the day that are being presented to us. Coming at us at a rapid rate. Don't even know which one is a priority any longer because they all seem like a priority. So you're in the right place at the right time because not only do we lightly go over some of the issues of the day, but we also have a section of authors and experts. We enter into the world of authors and experts every Wednesday with very special guests. And they are experts in their field. And most have written books and are well established in their fields from around the globe. And today we are going to be welcoming Darlene Quinn. And she is a fabulous guest because she has written a 6-book web series in recent years. And she is a mystery writer. And today she's going to not only share her story and her books, and she's going to give us tips on the literary world and how to celebritize yourself. So if you're looking to write a book or become an actor or an expert in your field, this is the right place to be. And just to mention this webs of a series of 6 books. The number one web mystery story is Web of Fate, and the number two is Webs of Power. Number three is Twisted Webs. Number four is Unpredictable Webs. Number five is Conflicting Webs. And number six, her latest book, is Webs of Perception. So you just may want to check that out online and at Amazon.com. And right now, we're going to go to the issues of the day before we speak to our very special guest and enter into the world of authors and experts, because we have some interesting facts going on around the world. One of the disturbing facts around the world is that the Venezuelans are now marked with numbers, just like in World War II when Hitler marked each Jew and every person that he didn't particularly like with numbers on their arms. And they had to stand in line to get food and to be identified. We have social security numbers and driver's license numbers. So we're also identified, but not by having the government stamp our arms. And this particular article comes out of businessinsider.com, so it's very credible. And I've seen photos of the Venezuelans having to stand in line for water and a loaf of bread. This article says it's hard to get a sense of what a food shortage is like unless you have lived through one. But it's like everything, unless you have lived through that particular injustice, legal abuse, or hard times, you really don't have a true sense of what it feels like. But this tidbit from Venezuela serves as a chilling illustration. The lines to get into government supermarkets are so long that people mark their arms with their place in line. It's not a permanent tattoo, just a pen. But the point is to make sure that the long lines stay as orderly as possible. It looks like this. The road to serfdom game in Venezuela just got real. Human tattooing for food privileges. pic.twitter.com. You can look that up. According to a source familiar with what's going on, this number, scribbling, takes place outside large cities like Caracas, and it doesn't happen in private supermarkets. However, private supermarkets can set a limit to the number of items a person can buy. For example, you can only pick up 4 liters of milk, 2 liters of oil, 2 kilos of sugar, etc. Do you think this could happen in the United States of America? With an unknown number, says the government, of unidentified foreigners flooding into our country illegally, and the professors at Yale University, who I believe are more credible than the government who's guesstimating, says that there are between 16 million to 29 million illegals, and they're still flowing into our country, coming into the USA, which means it's going to hurt our economy and our food supply because we are having flooding and wildfires and tornadoes, and many of them are unprecedented within 50 to 100 years. Now, when these events occur, these natural disasters, they affect our crops, our fruit, our vegetables. They affect the supply and the demand, and they skyrocket the cost. And then with the 29 million plus illegals still flowing into our country who are now being placed on welfare, housing, food stamps, and many are polygamous who have several wives and many children who get up to $350,000 a year from the taxpayers, even though polygamy is a crime in the USA that is ignored. But nonetheless, this is what's happening in America. Our food supply is being diminished by natural disasters, and that means our taxes must be increased and our wages will be decreased to feed people who don't belong in our country, who are non-citizens. God bless them, but America cannot afford to feed the world's poor while we have tens of thousands of legal natural-born Americans and hungry children in our own country. And it's not getting better according to the statistics. So the article says, and that's if the market even has those items. People also have numbers on their ID cards, well, we do too, which decide which days they can even get into line to shop at supermarkets like San Cristobal's Bicentenario, according to AFP. Protests taking place all over the country in Venezuela aren't helping either. Demonstrators have been building barricades, which are slowing the flow of goods from place to place. And that is from the AFP. Very credible resource. And so you may want to check it out, because, and you may want to research the information on the flooding that has hit the breadbasket and the wildfires and the Midwest, where they do a lot of farming and provide a lot of fruits and vegetables and so forth, milk and eggs and all the things that we take advantage of, because we've always been the nation of plenty. Well, we could become the nation of rationing if we are not careful, not only with food, because if we don't get the correct food supplies to the markets, we can also suffer because of the economic system, the welfare system being drained, the food stamps being drained, that were intended for legal Americans who were down and out on their luck, who paid into these systems, into the Social Security, into Medicare, and still do, who paid into welfare, who paid into HUD, who paid into Obamacare and so forth, in order to be taken care of just in case they needed a helping hand. For example, a serious illness can devastate you. A divorce can devastate your life. Death can devastate your life. Or not having the right skills or tools or education to pick yourself up in case you lose your job. Many, many good reasons that turn a good life into a difficult life. And homelessness are valid reasons why Americans decided that they were willing to pay into these programs most of their lives, and most Americans never use them. So these are very, very important issues of the day. And let's go to another issue of the day. In fact, my former cable TV show that I produced and hosted for many years, along with a radio shows on AM/FM radio, were entitled Issues of the Day. So, according to Breaking911.com, there are 1,700 suspected child sex predators arrested during nationwide operation called Broken Heart. Well, this is a good thing. The Department of Justice today announced the arrest of almost 1,700 suspected online child sex offenders during a two-month nationwide operation conducted by Internet Crimes Against Children and against the Children Task Forces. The task forces identified 308 offenders who either produced child pornography or committed child sexual abuse, and 357 children who suffered recent, ongoing or historical sexual abuse, or were exploited in the production of child pornography. So children are at high risk today, and we as adults must do our best to inform everyone of these sexual predators and that their children are at high risk, and they must monitor their children more carefully than at least when I was growing up, where they didn't really worry about it at all, because the neighborhoods were very, very safe, and every neighbor knew everyone, and every neighbor was allowed to discipline children who did something wrong and report it to the parents. So kids were aware of these facts, and they did not want to do much wrongdoing during that time. But they were not worried about child pornography, they were not worried about sex trafficking children and kidnapping their children. That would have made big news, and it would have been condemned, and it would have been shocking to the nation. The 61 ICAC task force is located in all 50 states and comprised of more than 4,500 federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies, led the coordinated operation known as Broken Heart during the months of April and May of 2019. God bless them. During the course of the operation, the task forces investigated more than 18,500 complaints of technology, facilitated crimes targeting children, and delivered more than 2,150 presentations on internet safety to over 201,000 youth and adults. So it's really refreshing to know that the government is actually doing something about these issues, and they are current issues that are happening today. And it's very important that we as Americans understand that we are responsible for all children in America, even if they are not our biological children. We are responsible to protect them. And the judges are responsible by law to monitor the welfare and safety of every minor child. So on that note, I want you to think about that. I'm going to take a break, and we will be back in just a moment.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Hi, Erwin. Where's your guest?
Keeping up with the news these days is like keeping up with the car... Well, you get the idea. There's a lot of yelling and screaming. Intelligent discussion? Not so much. Ready for something refreshing, thought-provoking, and friendly? Okay, grab your favorite hot or cold drink, sit down, and listen to a friendly voice. The Columbo Chronicles Live with Rose Columbo on Blog Talk Radio. Every Wednesday night at 8 on the West Coast, or 11 for anyone sleepless on the East Coast, Rose Columbo welcomes dynamic authors and experts on a myriad of human interest topics. From politics to love, the environment, the mafia, healthcare, and more. It's 60 minutes of original entertainment and intriguing information with the top VIP guests. Senator John DeCamp exposing the Franklin cover-up. Dr. Tony O'Donnell, the herb doc. Dr. Alan Keyes discussing the White House. So, from Rose Columbo's home on the Columbo Chronicles Live to your home, Columbo.
Listening is an art that humans are losing to the world of robots. Robots don't have any tone or human feelings. The addiction to communicate by texting isn't going away. People are feeling isolated, lonely, frustrated. People need people willing to listen to them. Can you imagine getting a text message that read, "You're fired," or "Hi, would you marry me?" It is happening. Columbo Chronicles is the option and the answer to human communication. Columbo Chronicles provides email access to your ideas and issues. Take advantage of this opportunity now. Go to columbochronicles.com. Click on subscribe today. Columbo is spelled C-O-L-O-M-B-O Chronicles. Fill out the form, submit it, bookmark and subscribe today. Remember the name, ColumboChronicles.com.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up, because we have important issues of the day that we need to discuss and communicate to our families and our friends. And I was just talking about Venezuela, where they have to stand in line now and be numbered to get a loaf of bread and some water and hopefully a few other grocery items, which are limited. And the article went on to say that Armando Miranda, vice president of Takira State Bakeries Association, told the AFP that San Cristobal could run out of bread by Tuesday. That's shocking. They could run out of bread in Venezuela by Tuesday, which was, what, yesterday? We already had shortages before, and now nothing is arriving. Miranda said after addressing a peace conference organized by the government to end the protests, but shunned by the opposition as a sham. This article by Business Insider says most shops and restaurants are closed in the city of 260,000 people. Can you imagine if in America suddenly you were told you needed to stand in line for a loaf of bread and some water and hopefully a few other items, and that they were going to run out of bread by Tuesday? How would you feel? What would you do? Well, this is what's happening in Venezuela and other countries. And on Friday, Maduro got on TV and said that smuggling food into the country is more profitable than selling cocaine. So now we have not only trafficking kids, trafficking females, trafficking guns, trafficking drugs to worry about. We have trafficking foods into countries like Venezuela as becoming a multi-billion dollar business. So if that isn't shocking, I don't know what is. It is shocking to me, and it should be shocking to you. So we need to remain alert, and we need to see what our government is going to do to help the people in Venezuela from this monster named Maduro. And on that note, we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts. And today we have a wonderful author and expert. Her name is Darlene Quinn. I told you a little bit about her books in the beginning of the show. And it's a delight to have this internationally known author as our guest today on Colombo Chronicles. She is the highly respected Darlene Quinn, who's written 6 bookwebs, a series in recent years. And her latest books, I read to you each of the titles, and she is not only going to discuss her latest book, which is Webs of Perception, she is going to tell us a little bit about herself, and she's going to share how to celebritize yourself. So if you're an author or an expert and you want more attention brought to yourself and the books or your expertise, then you're in the right place at the right time. So let's just get started in the world of authors and experts, and let's say hello to Darlene Quinn. Welcome, Darlene Quinn. How are you today?
I am great, and it's nice to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you on our show, Darlene. So from what I understand, you are going to be a guest speaker this evening and going to speak about celebritizing yourself at the Southern California Publishers Meeting in Studio City. And so that's pretty exciting and in itself, that you're going to provide all this information to so many experts and authors that will be in attendance. And so why don't you tell us, how did you personally get started in the literary world?
Well, you just mentioned that rather strange event that I'm going to be speaking at. which I am very excited about. I am, as an author, I am acting as a publicist for my publicist. Anyway, it was just sort of a twist on the book, Celebratize Yourself. But you asked a little bit about me, so I will tell you that. I'm sort of an unlikely author. I started out as a young person always being a storyteller. I love telling stories. But I was brought up in the time where they taught sight reading instead of phonics. Therefore, my papers all looked like they had the measles with all these little red circles on spelling. So I never thought I'd become a writer, you know, on the written word. And probably if we had not come to the days of computers, I may never have done that. I've had a very checkered resume. I was a school teacher, a model, had my own modeling courses, and then was a corporate training director for the Bullock's department stores, which was a large group of department stores, one of the largest on the West Coast. Their stores are now either Macy's or I was on the management team of their specialty division, Bullock's Wilshire, and those are all probably Macy's or Bloomingdale's or have disappeared from our landscape. So how did I become an author? What was happening in the world of retail was so unbelievable, and I had worked with all these movers and shakers in the land of department stores. And I decided that I wanted to write a novel. I didn't want to go into all the details. If you really wanted to know all about corporate takeovers, leverage buyouts, and all that thing, you'd go to a nonfiction book. But I was interested in the people that made things happen. So what I write is faction, page-turning, suspense, character-driven, but the backgrounds are authentic. My background happens to be the world of department stores, or you might read another novel that was set in World War II. So everything that happens in World War II is authentic. However, the novel isn't about World War II, nor are my novels about the background. They are about the people and the people that get entwined in it. What I did learn very quickly I never intended to write a series. That thought would have blown my mind. I wanted to write a novel. I thought this would be really cool. What had drove me to that as I was on the management team of the Bullock's Wilshire stores, my daughter, who was severely deaf, was having a hard time in high school. So I resigned to help her. But I really wasn't suited to, I cleaned the closets, but after I'd done that, that didn't really thrill me, and I was playing some tennis. I needed more to do. So I started writing some articles for Savvy Magazine, Innskeeping World, and things like that, but they were nonfiction. They were on negotiating skills, time management, interviewing skills. And then I thought, well, I really need to hone my skills. You know, I would like to write something more than just this. And so I took a writing class at Long Beach City College. And, well, it was just a general writing class and was learning to use a computer because I hadn't typed since I was in college on a manual typewriter. And as an executive in the retail industry, my secretaries wouldn't let me go near the electric typewriters because I made a mess. So, and when I was head of personnel and organization development for the Bullock's Wilshire stores is when computers were really personal computers were gaining ground. And so my staff took care of those. I knew nothing about those. So I would say the first article I wrote for Savvy Magazine, which I think paid $500, I probably made 5 cents an hour by the time I got it onto a piece of paper. So I didn't do it for the money. Then as things were progressing in the retail, the world of retail, there were so many bizarre things happening that I decided that's where I wanted to write. And I'd worked with a lot of these movers and shakers in the field. I knew them and their personalities. And the characters in my books are based on these personalities and the professional jumps from here to there. Their personal lives are total pure fiction because I just sticking to the facts was dull. But my first book, the background was the takeover of the Federated Department Stores, which was the largest retailer in the U.S. at that time. And this was end of the 80s going into the 90s. And what was going on there was so intriguing to me, but I found out real soon that fiction must be believable. Real life has none of those restraints. And so my first book was this takeover. The corporate raider was a man with 2 nervous breakdowns, liposuction, a facelift, a hair transplant, and he filled his pool, swimming pools, with water, with mineral water. However, I didn't give my character a wife and family in one city and a mistress and family in another, all true of a Canadian who fell in love with the Bloomingdale stores and wanted to take over all of Federated.
Wow.
My character I've put in Australia, but he seems somewhat unbelievable, but all of those factors were true. I just had to tone him down. And real life is often just not that believable.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
So, not thinking about writing a series, I didn't think about that, but my characters had other ideas. So, they have gone from book to book. I love my characters, and I miss them right now. My next project is a standalone because the series came to an end with my last book, Webs of Perception. And the reason I ended the series, they still had a lot of ways to go. However, I don't write detective stories. I don't write mysteries, although there's mystery in some of them. It's more suspense. So I have killed off very few characters since the mid-80s. Therefore, and those have either died of natural causes or because they really deserve to die. So my cast has grown. In my first book, which is a takeover of the Federated Stores and the selling off of the West Coast to Macy's, it parallels that. Then in the book that followed it, Twisted Webs, one of my characters has twins, and on the day of their birth, one of these twins is kidnapped. The reader starts out, when I write in a thriller style, and by that what I mean is the reader always knows more than the individual characters. And so they start out, they meet the kidnapper. They find out he is a good, religious man who, out of love and desperation, has committed this heinous crime and knows he's going to live an eternity in hell.
Wow.
Some writers do long outlines and everything else. I can't do that. Mine are character driven, and I knew in this book that I was going to have this kidnapped child, and she was going to come back to her parents at one point, but I didn't know how I was going to get there or where it was going to end, and I had a very faulty notion with this book, because my first book started at the end of the 80s to the 90s. I thought, well, in this one, I'll bring it up to date, because I had to do lots of research and make sure that what I did. I did send somebody to a Starbucks, but there were none then. So my copy editor catches that. They catches, you know, I research things very carefully, and I even had one of the characters living in this condo. I researched it. I knew how to get there. And my copy editor said, sorry, that wasn't built for another 6 months. So make sure that everything is correct.
But, yes, that's believable, right?
Right. And we find out that this man that kidnapped the child, and I'm not going to tell you very much about him, but his wife had lost her last opportunity to have a child. They tried to adopt. They had in vitro, and she was devastated. He was a nurse practitioner in Long Beach, going to be moving to New York, and he was coming in. He'd met this unwed mother who wanted a better life for her child, and he was coming home with a baby girl. He arrived at the hospital, and she was gone. And he promised his wife this baby girl and saw that someone had twins. And that's all I'm going to tell you about that one.
That's exciting.
Yes. I had reader feedback, and they wanted to know more about their favorite characters. And so I thought, this is great, because my first attempt at a novel, I'd called Bentley's Royale, because I call my stores Bentley's and Bentley's Royale instead of Bullocks and Bullocks Wilshire. And I'd written that book, but it didn't go anywhere. I did get an agent, but it just didn't go anywhere. So I thought, I've already written that book. That would be really cool. But I went back to it. My first 65 pages were backstory. And then as I was going through it, it had the characters, it had a good plot, it had everything else, but I rewrote that book from a blank screen. And it was
Do you write your stories with, handwrite them, or do you type them?
I will tell you, as far as my handwriting has gotten so bad, that I don't read that very well. Besides, I found that pens and pencils don't spell any better than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, yeah. I seem to think through my fingers, and even writing ideas down or something, I think of things, but I really tend to, and sometimes usually how I start my writer's day is I read the chapter that I wrote the day before just to get started and go from there. And I will have a vague idea. Usually I know where my books start and where they will end, but I'm not sure how I'm going to get there.
I see.
But and some people do, my friend who you know, who actually my first published book was one I wrote for a friend that you and your listeners probably all know, unless they are real young. And that was Buddy Ebsen.
Yes, I was going to say, I understand that the famous TV actor, Buddy Ebsen, who was a character actor for many years before he became a big star on television, actually got you involved in your writing efforts? Is that correct?
No, he didn't actually get me involved. I had already written what I called Bentley's Royale, and which didn't go anywhere. And at that time, my late husband was diagnosed with frontal temporal dementia. And that book actually, it was Webs of Power. I had also written Webs of Power at that time. It had not been published. But I had written the book. It was with an editor at HarperCollins, and they wanted me to cut 10,000 words. Well, I wouldn't
wow.
know how to do that today. I don't have enough buts and ands in my work. And at the time, my husband was diagnosed with frontal temporal dementia, and lots of things were going on. So I pulled back the manuscript and just put it away. And then buddy I got to know on a New Year's Eve at a yacht club that we belonged to. And we got to know him, and my late husband had him do a couple of shows for us at the yacht club. A very accomplished man. He was fabulous. And so we invited him to a Christmas party that we had, and at that time I was in a critique group. I was unpublished. I'd done articles and things, but an unpublished writer. And we had a Christmas party, and we invited Dorothy and his wife and Buddy. And he was an acquaintance. He was not a friend at that time. He was an acquaintance. And he had just written his autobiography, which was called The Other Side of Oz. You may not know, but many people do, many people do not. Buddy was actually the first Tin Man for The Wizard of Oz.
No, I didn't know
and,
that.
Okay, he was the original Tin Man. And how they did the costuming, they put white grease paint and they powdered him with aluminum powder, which got
awful.
Into his lungs. He was hospitalized.
Yeah.
He almost died. He was hospitalized for six weeks and was replaced by Haley in The Wizard of Oz. He's still in. He is in some scenes where they had filmed him in the Tin Man costume and did some voiceovers. But anyway, at that party, his wife said, you know, Buddy's trying to write his first novel. Do you think maybe he could come to your critique group? And I said, oh, sure, it'd be terrific. And so nothing happened. And a while later, Buddy called, and he said, I finished my novel. Do you think I could come to your critique group and read a little bit of it? And so I said, well, Buddy, why don't you send me the first two or three chapters, and we'll, you know, because I knew if he came and read it, he could read the telephone book, and he'd probably do a good job. So he sent me his novel, which happened to be very short, and he was excellent. I mean, he had dialogue and everything else. However, Buddy did not describe anything that the camera would pick up. And so we'd be in a room that wouldn't be a room there. And so I was horrified because I thought, who am I, an unpublished author, telling Buddy Ebsen this isn't a novel? And so I had a friend who was a director of community theaters that he directed mm-hmm. across the country. He'd been an actor, and he was in my critique group. So we took that. Actually, Buddy couldn't have sent me his first two or three chapters. He sent me the book because there were no chapters.
Oh.
So
that's quite a book. It's all one chapter.
Right. And as I say, it was really, I mean, there was just no description of anything. And so I thought it was when scanners first came into existence. And a scanner at that time, if you bought one, was like $800. And I didn't have one, but one of my friends had one. So I scanned the whole thing, and I arbitrarily made it into chapters. I didn't change anything, But I arbitrarily made it into chapters, just, you know, and ending them like I do mine. I try to end every one of my chapters with the reader wanting to know what happens next. And his chapters, I had really gotten that far in my own writing to know exactly what I was doing. I mean, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And so I gave a copy, and all I did with it was change the formatting and break it into chapters, and I gave it back to Buddy, and I gave it to my friend, and we both went through it. He was extremely receptive, really. There, I mean, he was just the man you saw on TV, is whether it was Jed Clampett or Barnaby Jones or Georgie Russell on screen, or I can't watch Breakfast at Tiffany's and the scene with Audrey Hepburn without crying. I just can't do it. So he was excellent in so many ways, but he was very receptive and just a joy to work with, and we became very good friends.
That's a fantastic story.
Yes, when he died at the age of 95, he was writing a Barnaby Jones novel. And so his widow asked me to complete the novel for him. And he'd called it The Legend of Laurie London, I think. And fortunately, his wife gave me the go-ahead to do what I wanted. And it is his story, the basis of that book, but he only had 35 pages. But it is his story. But it wasn't long enough for a novel, so I added some subplots, a major subplot to it. But Barnaby Jones, I ran into a real problem because Barnaby Jones is a real fictional character. If you Google online Barnaby Jones, you can see a synopsis of every show. And at that time, way back, it was in the 70s, it was the longest running TV detective story. Beverly Hillbillies made the record way before that for long runs. But with him not describing where you were, if Barnaby was riffling through files in his office, there was no office, and I knew I'd be crucified if I didn't get the office right. And so his widow went to Quinn Martin, who had produced it, and they had sold the rights to someone else. She could not get a single video. And so she gave me a huge stack of the original scripts. Well, they were great for dialogue, but what they said is pan into office. I feared I was going to have to blow up the office. And that's what I thought I was going to have to do, because I knew I couldn't describe it wrong. I couldn't get it wrong. So I was going to blow it up. Fortunately, his wife is German, and there was a fan in Germany that had taped every single episode.
Was that?
No, she wasn't in Germany. She was German, and she had taped every, you know, I never thought about that before. I just said it, because if she was taping them in Germany, it would have been in German, and they were translated. So she was here, and she sent me 3 videotapes. So I did not blow up at all.
Wow, that was very lucky indeed. So you didn't have to blow it up.
No, I didn't blow it up. And although it's a totally different genre, it's a detective story, I enjoyed doing it. I wrote it in Buddy's voice, or Barnaby, whichever, which are one and the same. And it was really fun doing it. Not writing it wrong. But at that time, self-publishing had not come out of the dark ages, and his widow did not want to submit to the regular publishers. She wanted to keep the rights. So we published that book through a print-on-demand publisher. It's a big print-on-demand publisher. And I, in my infancy, although I wasn't that young, but my infancy as a writer, did not understand the importance of editing. We had it proofread, and, you know, for that, and but it was not edited. And I don't think any author should send a book out into this world without an editor, because we're too close to what we write. We don't see the flaws.
Oh, that's for sure. I mean, I've written things, and I go back and I go, that doesn't even make sense, or how did I write that? What in the world was I thinking?
I would never do that. And then I was called to be on this radio show that's, it was about TV shows. It was a radio show that talked about TV shows, and the name of it just escapes me. And I was going to be on the show with Lee Merriweather, who was Buddy's co-star in there. And I had to send a book. So I told my publisher, I said, you know, that book isn't edited. I mean, it was kind of like on the back burner. I didn't really do it. And actually, I renamed the book Sizzling Cold Case, and then I put The Legend of Laurie London and the Barnaby Jones book. And it has only started selling since my books are selling, and because my name is on it too, because we did no promotion. You know, we did so many things wrong, but I had to be on there. So the host of the show loved it. He said, oh, those characters just popped off the page. They were wonderful. And so I still wasn't confident. And I really kind of just discarded it. But two or three years ago, Buddy Ebsen's youngest daughter and son put together this huge show called A Tribute to Buddy Ebsen, where they put, or you saw him in all of the different things that he'd been in. It was a fabulous show. And his daughter said, do you think we could make this into an audiobook? Because she had copies of them. And they've sold minimally well. And so at the time, I had just sent my latest novel into my editor, which gives me about a month. And it had been over 10 years since the book came out in 2007. Came out in 2006. So it had been a long enough time, and I said, not until I edit it. And I was able to, I had the distance from it, and I had such a funny experience. I mean, it was a delightful experience doing this, because as I read it, I could hear Buddy's voice. I could absolutely hear his voice, or Barnaby's voice. And then I would discover, oh, wait a minute, that character wasn't there. That scene wasn't there. So I was really feeling good. And as I went through it, I made some changes, but they weren't horrendous. And the funny thing that happened is I didn't know who the murderer was. I got caught up in my own story. I didn't know who the murderer was. And that was a part that he had done. I mean, if I had devised this, I'm sure I'd never would have done it, but I was working in his framework. And many of the words are straight Buddy, because he did do it, you know, very well. He was a very talented man.
So so what kind of tips would you give people out there who are, you know, wanting to be or want to be writers or experts or become well-known? Do they need a book publicist? What do they need, I mean, to help themselves improve?
Absolutely. They need the desire and the passion for their work. And I don't think any of us can do it on our own. In the when I was asked to fill in for Marcia in this book publisher's thing, and her book is Celibatize Yourself. And sometimes celibatize, you're thinking ego or something, or megastars, movie stars, and everything else. But in Marcia's world, and how we think about it, is getting yourself known, and not for selfish reasons, but we all within us have a certain amount of celebrity. We all have expertise in something that could benefit others. And that's where it helps most, is where you have something you want to share that can help others. And actually, her book, Celibatize Yourself, which is excellent, is more going toward the nonfiction, and it is, but you need it in fiction too. And that is, if you're going to become well known as an expert, become an expert in that field, whether it happens to be an expert in cooking, like Martha Ray, an expert in acting, an expert in whatever, a handyman. In fact, one woman made a huge thing out of hire a husband and all of the things that a single woman would love. And
I like that, hire a husband.
Well,
you
know, when I was a
retail.
Well, actually, when I was an executive, what I needed was a wife.
I
wanted to hire a wife.
That is so funny and so cute and so true. Well, I have totally enjoyed speaking with you, Darlene Quinn, and now's your time to shine. You have about 60 seconds to tell our audience anything about yourself, your books, and how to contact you if you have social media, and how to get your books.
I would be delighted to do that. My books are, I write in bite-sized chapters, and the biggest complaint my readers have is staying up all night going 3 or 4 more pages. They can be found on my website, darlenequinn.net, and anywhere books are sold, actually, on all the online retailers. They come in print, in e-book, and in audio book formats, in all three. Let's see.
Perfect.
Social media. I am on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Google+. I run one of the largest writer-reader sites on Facebook, which is called Talking Fiction. And we have just gotten up, we're just almost at 6,000 members, but it is a great interactive book group talking about fiction, not just a book thing and buy my book. We limit promotion to just 2 days a week.
Oh, that's perfect. So what is the website for Talking Fiction?
Talking Fiction on Facebook.
It
you
is
just,
on Facebook. It's
on Facebook, and it's called Talking Fiction.
Perfect. And then, of course, all your books can be seen and are featured on Amazon.com, so people can check them out and purchase them. And I wish you much success, and I look forward to seeing you tonight as well, and look forward to hearing more about Celibatize Yourself as well. Thank you so much,
right,
Darlene Quinn.
Thank you, Rose.
You're welcome. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
And Darlene Quinn has left the building. And, of course, you can check out all her books. And there's suspense books, and there's a list of them. There's a last book is Webs of Perception. And then you can start at the beginning at Web of Fate and move on up to Web of Power. And Twisted webs, unpredictable webs, and conflicting webs, all featured on Amazon.com. And, of course, you can go to Facebook, Talking Fiction. And I do hope that you do think about Venezuela and this monster, Maduro, their leader, who are now numbering the people, running out of bread, and making the statement that bread is now the new item for trafficking to build up a multi-billion-dollar business. Food, bread, water in their country. You can't get much more evil than that. And instead of a coup against the President of the United States, they're, in my opinion, should be looking at removing this guy from destroying the lives of a country that was once free, prosperous, has plenty of oil, should not be in this position. And this is what socialism and communism does to a country. So do your homework, do your research, and thank God that you were born in the United States of America. And it is our duty as natural-born Americans to protect the office of the President of the United States. I'm not talking about whether you like a president, don't like a president. That has occurred since time began. It's about preserving and the respect for the office of the President of the United States, preserving the United States Constitution, secure borders, identification, legal identification, legal driver's licenses, and to stop the invasion of illegals from coming into our country because they are in violation of our sovereignty. They have disrespected the American people. They have disrespected the law enforcers, TSA, ICE, Border Patrol, sheriffs. They have disrespected the Constitution of the United States of America. And they are not entitled to be here and to receive taxpayer-funded entitlements. They should be detained and deported and come through the ports of entry legally. This is not against immigrants. It's against illegal immigration, which is a crime in the United States of America. People need, foreigners need to do like every other country. You cannot cross into their borders illegally or you will be shot or you will be thrown into a horrible pit where they will abuse you. So no other country in the world allows illegal immigration. And as far as I'm concerned, the legislators who support illegal immigration are aiding and abetting, harboring, and materially assisting people who are in violation of the law and possibly have fake IDs, stolen IDs, are unidentified, possibly in cartels, dangerous gangs, jihadists, and terrorists. And in fact, just this week, President Trump and the Department of Justice is deporting a terrorist from our country back to his country, back to his homeland. We should not have jihadists taking over states like in Michigan and recruiting American kids into becoming jihadists, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts being indoctrinated, or prisoners being forced in the United States to be indoctrinated into a foreign ideology that they do not want to be a part of, but are being forced by threats into that ideology. Wake up, America. Wake up and protect your country, protect your borders, protect our sovereignty, and return detain and release to detain and deport. They can come in legally through ports of entry, and as well, the Constitution of the United States requires inspections. They are mandated by law to inspect every foreigner who comes into the USA. And that is aside from all of the diseases, communicable infectious diseases that are in California on coming across the USA, which allegedly includes bubonic plague, which is totally deadly, Ebola, which is totally deadly, tuberculosis, hepatitis, measles, chickenpox, SARS, foot fungus, etc., etc., etc. So God bless you. God bless the President of the United States and all of those who support his efforts to secure our borders. And God bless you and all law enforcement.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.